Hi there, this is George R.R. Martin. I'm the author of The Pointy End, the episode that we're about to view. And, of course, I'm also the author of A Game of Thrones, the novel, first volume of A Song of Ice and Fire, which is the series of fantasy novels that the show is based on. So I have sort of a double threat here. I was the person who provided the underlying material being adapted and the one doing the adaptation, which sometimes creates a strange conflict of interest for a writer or a screenwriter. Back in the days when I first started working in television on the CBS revival of The Twilight Zone from the mid-80s, Phil Daguerre, who ran the show, would never let any of us adapt our own stories because he always felt the original writer was too close to make the necessary changes. But fortunately, that's not the case with David Benioff and Dan Weiss and the folks at HBO, so I was able to have a role in the adaptation and do one script per season for the show. The credit sequence that you're watching now is something that I've loved since I first saw it. One of the big things about fantasy is, of course, it takes place in an imaginary realm. And the geography is very important, so getting the map in right at the beginning to establish where these places are is a terrific idea.
Left high, left low.
The sequence picks up immediately after the end of the last episode, where the Lannisters are moving against Ned Stark. The king is dead, so it's all taking place practically simultaneously with the end of the last episode.
Do you break anything? The scepter will have my head.
All of the Stark men being slaughtered here.
Well, we were to leave today. How she could forget it, she didn't forget.
She's with her dancing master. She's with him every morning. She always comes back with scrapes and bruises. She's so clumsy.
Hush. Go back to your room. Bar the doors. And do not open them for anyone you do not know.
What is it? What's happening?
Do as I told you. Run!
Lovely shot here, I think. The courage of Septa Mordain facing the men with swords.
Right. Now you are dead.
You said right.
Miltos and Maisie playing Arya Stark and Cyril Forel, her dancing master, have been some of my favorites since the show began. Maisie is just amazing as Arya, and Miltos has really done an incredible job.
Dead girl, the seeing, the true seeing.
In the books, Cyril Forel is bald. And of course, when Miltos was cast, there were a number of fans who said, he has all this hair, he's not bald. But that's the sort of trivial thing that you really shouldn't worry about when you're making an adaptation. He is Cyril. He brings the character to life wonderfully, and that's the important thing.
This is no concern of yours.
My father wouldn't send you. And I don't have to go with you if I don't want.
Take her.
Are you men or snakes that you would threaten a child?
Get out of my way, little man.
I am Cyril Forel.
Foreign bastard.
Now, this action sequence, I think, is terrific, but it's one of the things where you see how the interrelated nature of doing film affects what you see on the screen.
Run to your father.
In the books, the armor of the Lannister men-at-arms is somewhat different. Their helmets are open-faced. They have a lion on top of them. And they're unarmored, largely other than that. So when Sirio fights them all, he breaks a number of their knees by striking at their unprotected knees, and he also uses that wooden sword to actually kill a few by breaking their noses or driving the wooden sword through the eyes. Of course, when the armor was designed here, the Lannister guards have full-face helmets, which was just sort of a different look in the early episodes, but we get to this episode, and you have to adjust the nature of the fight scene, because, of course, he now can't drive his wooden sword through the eye of any of these people because they have facial protection. But the rest of the sequence is very close to the way I wrote it, both in the book and in my script, and I think they did a marvelous job on this. Here, Arya makes her decision to go down instead of up.
Not safe. Not safe.
In the script, the scene goes on a little further where she actually passes through the dragon skulls, which we've seen her discover in the previous episodes. So we know that she's escaped the city because we know that passage leads out.
I'll tell my father. I'll tell the queen.
Who do you think?
But that was cut for reasons of time here. And it's followed by that beautiful scene between the Hound, Sandor Clegane, and Sansa.
Need it.
And here, of course, Arya is finding her sword, Needle, which has been packed away for the girl's return to Winterfell.
My father's a lord. He'll reward you.
She'll reward me. The queen.
Stay away!
And Arya's first kill. I do miss, in the book, when the stable boy is stared, he says, take it out. Sort of a sad, plaintive little line, and of course, when she takes it out, he dies. And that was in the script, but I gather it was not used for some reason. I rather miss that. I like that line.
Lord Stark, you must be thirsty.
Varys.
I promise you, it isn't poison. Why is it no one ever trusts the eunuch?
I think the set that they're using here is actually the same set that they used for the Crypts of Winterfell in the earlier episodes that were set up north.
Not so much, my lord.
They've removed the statues of the dead kings and all that. But they're using the same subterranean set to be the black cells under the Red Keep of King's Landing.
The only one seems to have escaped the castle. Even my little birds cannot find her.
And Sansa?
Still engaged to Joffrey. Cersei will keep her close.
In the books,
the rest of your household, though.
One thing about Varys is that he is a master of disguise, and in his youth, he is a mummer, which is an actor, so to speak, and learned certain tricks of disguise and of taking on other identities. So, in court, he is the perfumed eunuch, frequently in robes with powdered face, very soft, very effeminate, playing that role. But down in the dungeons, he has a whole separate identity as Rugen, a jailer, who in the books wears a iron cap, and he has a kind of a gruff, stubbly beard, which of course is artificial.
The wine slowed him down.
Makeup, so to speak, a medieval makeup that they put on, just to give him a different appearance. They've simplified that here, obviously.
I trust you know you're a dead man.
Varys is not in his court robes, but he's not in his full Rugen persona either.
You can't kill me. Cahill's a brother.
The wrong brother, sadly. And lost to her. Your wife has let the imp slip through her fingers.
I love the way Sean reacts to that, just with his face showing the impact that that revelation has on him.
And slit my throat and be done with it.
Not today, my lord.
Tell me something, Varys.
And that not today that he delivers is an interesting echo of not today that Sirio teaches Arya.
Someone must.
All of that, the not today riff was added by David Benioff and Dan Weiss. Wonderful addition to the books. And now we switch to the wall.
It's Otho, without a doubt.
The other one's Jaffa Flowers, my lord. Best to hand the wolf tore off.
Any sign of Benjen?
These are two of the men who rode north with Benjen Stark when he led the ranging out. In the books,
the smell.
You know, they're established a little earlier, especially Othor, the big one.
There is none. If they'd been dead for a long time, wouldn't they be rot?
And now Sam is talking a little about some anomalies about the corpses.
Smell's not wrong, my lord. Fire will do for them. The wildling way.
I want Maester Aemon to examine them first. You may be a coward, Tarly. You're not stupid. Get them inside.
Well, you heard him.
Lord Commander. Maester Aemon awaits you in his chambers.
In my original draft of the script, Sam has various other observations about the corpses.
Come on, move, move.
The black hands that the whites typically have.
Bring me a horn of ale, Snow. Pour one for yourself.
And now the news about Ned's arrest has reached the wall. And Jon Snow is about to hear some of it.
The king is dead.
One of the characters from the books who's missing in the series is Lord Commander Mormont's Raven, who is a very old raven, almost a pet, who's constantly with him in the books and who can talk.
Charged with treason.
Although his talking mostly consists of repeating a word or phrase that he's heard recently. The Raven is a somewhat controversial character, I guess, in the book, and some of my fans love him and wrote me, said, why did they leave out the Raven? I really liked the Raven. And other of my readers said, thank God they got rid of that annoying Raven. Boy, he's my least favorite part of the books. He's always breaking in to say corn, corn. So whether the Raven will ever show up, I don't know.
Your father has proved to be an awful traitor, dear.
King Robert's body was still warm when Lord Eddard began plotting to steal Joffrey's rightful throne.
He wouldn't do that. He knows how much I love Joffrey. He wouldn't. Please, Your Grace, there's been a mistake. Send for my father, he'll tell you. The king was his friend.
Sansa, sweetling, you were innocent of any wrong, we know that. Yet you are the daughter of a traitor. How can I allow you to marry my son?
This whole scenario here where Sansa, you know, just so wonderfully played by Sophie Turner, is being confronted by the queen and the men of the king's small council. The reader is supposed to get the impression that it's all been rehearsed. I mean, Sansa doesn't tweak to that, but certainly the characters do. They're doing an exaggerated version here of good cop, bad cop, or good counselor, bad counselor, in order to try to manipulate Sansa into writing the letter they want, because the Lannisters certainly had to get rid of Eddard Stark to avoid him handing over the throne to Stannis. But they don't want an all-out war, not at this stage.
If you would help your father.
And they're hoping still to use Sansa and Arya, if they can find her, to broker a peace. And the fact that they hold Ned, he's a very valuable hostage.
If I could see my father, talk to him about...
So Grandmaster Pycelle is the bad cop here, and Littlefinger is the good cop.
We've told you of your father's treason. Why would you want to speak to him?
Although Littlefinger has his own motivations, let us say, which go beyond just playing his role in this scenario.
What will happen to him?
Well, that depends.
On what?
On your brother. And on you.
And I love the interplay between Lena Headey and Sophie Turner there in that scene.
Treason. Sansa wrote this.
It is your sister's hand, but the Queen's words.
One of the things a television show needs to do, of course, is to move along fairly quickly. There's obviously a great amount of elapsed time that is taking place here. This is a royal command. Sansa was writing a letter a minute ago, and now the letter has already reached Robb in Winterfell, hundreds of leagues to the north. In the book, there's more of an implication of the passage of time. But a television show with only an hour, we have to move some of this along quickly.
They've all sworn to defend my father, have they not?
They have.
Now we see what the words are worth.
And Richard Madden has not had much opportunity to shine in the previous episodes as Robb, but he's an incredible actor, and with this episode and the ones that follow at the end of the season, I think he really comes into his own. And there's a great dynamic here between him and Alfie Allen as Theon. Stupid. Here we have the ravens taking off, which is just a little moment, but I love that moment. In the first draft of my script, I wrote a whole montage sequence there called The Calling of the Banners, where after the ravens took off, I showed the ravens being received at the Dreadfort, on Bear Island, at Last Hearth, at Carhold, and I showed all of the various secondary lords reacting to it one way or another, assembling their men, or riding out, or setting sail. It was a magnificent sequence. You know, when I handed in the first draft, David Benioff said, George, this is great, but it would take five times our budget for our entire season. So The Calling of the Banners had to go, which I kind of expected. There was always a joke during the 10 years I worked in Hollywood that my scripts, especially my first drafts, were always too long and too expensive. And I had to maintain that tradition now, didn't I? But I write my first drafts, I don't know, for myself. And then later, in subsequent drafts, when I go back, I cut and trim and eliminate things and make it producible. But in my head, in the alternate world where we have a budget of $20 million for each episode, we could do a great Calling of the Banners.
Time for your bath. I'll feed you after. If you fear for the safety of your son...
Of course I fear for the safety of my son.
Are you an idiot? They killed my husband. You say they shoved your boy from a window. These people will do anything, and that is why we have to stop them. The Knights of the Vale will stay in the Vale where they belong, to protect their lord.
I think it's a nice scene between the two sisters here. And now we see Bronn and Tyrion, who, having won their freedom in the trial by battle last episode, are now making their way through the Mountains of the Moon back to the Riverlands.
May as well be with a song in my heart.
I should just take your food and leave you here. Eh?
What would you do then?
It's established when they go to the Eyrie after Tyrion's capture that the Mountains of the Moon are very dangerous. The hill tribes are unruly, and they raid weakly defended parties, kill them or capture them. So by sending Tyrion out that way and not providing him a ship to sail from Gulltown, Lysa Tully has, in essence, expects him to die.
Fair enough. But don't go looking for me to bend the knee and malord you every time you take a shit. I'm not your toady, and I'm not your friend.
Though I would treasure your friendship, I'm mainly interested in your facility with murder. And if the day ever comes when you're tempted to sell me out, remember this. Whatever the price, I'll beat it.
Peter Dinklage has been incredible as Tyrion from the very first start. I mean, long ago, when we first started this project, even before HBO was involved, when I first met David Benioff and Dan Weiss over lunch one day in Los Angeles, to discuss the possibility of doing my books as a TV series. At a certain point in the proceedings, we started playing the casting game, as we often did, and saying who we saw as this role, who we saw as that role. And there was never anyone but Peter Dinklage for Tyrion. We did not read any other actors for the part. We did not audition anyone. We did not sound out anyone. The minute we started casting, it was, we have to get Peter Dinklage to play Tyrion. It's the only possible way to do it. And thankfully, we did. He is Tyrion. He's been incredible since the beginning.
When you meet your gods, you tell them Shagger, son of Dolph, of the Stone Crow, sent you.
I am Tyrion, son of Tywin, of Clan Lannister.
How would you like to die, Tyrion, son of Tywin?
In my own bed, at the age of 80, with a belly full of wine and a girl's mouth around my cock?
Take the half man. He can dance for the children. Kill the other one.
No, 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 no. My house is rich and powerful. If you see us through these mountains, my father will shower you with gold.
We have no use for a half man's promises.
Half a man, maybe. But at least I have the courage to face my enemies. What do the Stone Crows do? Hide behind rocks and shiver when the Knights of the Vale ride by. Those the best weapons you could steal?
That's Mark Lewis Jones as Shagga, son of Dolph.
Lannister Smith shit better steal.
Who becomes, ultimately, one of Tyrion's staunchest supporters. Along with Bronn. The dynamic between Tyrion and Bronn has always been something I've enjoyed writing about.
That trinket is worth more than everything your tribe earns. But if you help us, Shagga, son of Dolph, I will not give you trinkets. I will give you this.
What is this?
The Vale of Arryn. The Lords of the Vale have always spat upon the Hill Tribes. The Lords of the Vale want me dead. I believe it is time for new lords.
The Hill Tribes are the original owners of the Vale, as the books establish. You know, the continent of Westeros has undergone several invasions over the years.
Now there's a rare sight.
The first humans to rule Westeros were called the First Men. And then thousands of years later, the Andals came in. And the current Lords of the Vale are Andals, who, when they landed, drove the First Men, the original owners of the Vale, up into the mountains and hills, where they live a sort of meager existence ever since, but always dreaming about the lands and castles that they lost. And Tyrion knows all that, of course, so he's deliberately appealing to this desire on their part to get back to things that were taken from their great-grandfathers and other forebears. John has a bit of a temper. He let himself be goaded there by Sir Alistair Thorne. There's no love lost between the two of those.
Go.
And attacking a superior officer is not something tolerated in the Watch, no more than it is in any military organization. John is confined to quarters, and here, Ghost
What's wrong?
Senses that something is amiss.
Is someone out there?
And yes, Ghost is making noise. A number of fans have written me about that. The purists are quite upset about that. I'm not. Ghost in the books is completely silent, one of the reasons John names him Ghost. He's the only one of the direwolves who makes no noise. He does not growl or bark. But I assume that Dave and Dan tried that and found a little sound would make him a little more fearsome.
Stay.
There are things that one can imagine when one's writing a book that work fine in the imagination of readers. But when you actually put it on screen, you discover problems with it. It perhaps doesn't get across what you want it to get across.
Who's there?
So this is at night. Darkness has fallen. And the dead man, Othor and Jafer Flowers, have...
Lord Commander?
...both arisen. And here comes Othor, who is dead. Now, a little thing like sword through him doesn't actually stop the whites because they're dead to begin with. And indeed, that arm, that severed arm, in the book and in my first draft of the script, continues to fight itself, crawling across the floor. But fire stops him, as John correctly discerns here. So he burns his hand in it, but does manage to save the Lord Commander from the dead man. And now we're getting to the village of Dalazarin.
What do they do?
I should reckon Davri Zafran. Kadrogo Vajomora Azafroke. Majin Azafroke Vajikishan.
The Dothraki tongue was something that HBO especially commissioned to have written by an organization that specializes in creation of imaginary languages. David Peterson is one of the main fellows responsible for creating it, and it's just amazing that the actors have learned to speak it and managed to convey such wonderful meaning with what are essentially made-up words.
Jorah, make them stop.
Khaleesi.
You heard me.
These men have shed blood for their Khal. Now they claim their reward.
But I think it works much better with Dothraki and the subtitles than it would add if everyone was just speaking English.
You have a gentle heart. This is how it's always been.
I do not have a gentle heart, sir.
And Dany here is appalled by the rape and slaughter that she's seeing. Khal Drogo is moving. He's taken his Khalasar toward the sea to begin the conquest of Westeros, but it's quite a way to the sea, and of course they have to be fed, and when they reach the sea, they're going to need a way to get these ships to take them across. So slaving is one of the ways that the Dothraki earn money, although they don't look at it earn, they look at it as an exchange of gifts. The Dothraki do not actually believe in buying and selling in the same way as the more mercantile civilizations of the West. So Dany can't enact the idea of don't take slaves, but what she does there is saying, well, I'll take the slaves. I'm the queen. I'm the Khaleesi. All the slaves belong to me. And in that way, she can extend some protection over the women who were being raped.
Mago Asakat Shilari, Mashek Mishirakiani. And the request of San Ahariashek, Majin Morinembis, Majin Nembos Osaji.
Jinia Tala Jalar, Jin Churase Zafrajin, Majin Kisha Takimora, then Maya Balaya Pakisha.
Ananem Aliafak Vanza Digmora. Hash Totraki Shakit Sisajimora, Hash Morikit Momoa Mamora.
Hash Razig.
Jason Momoa is wonderful in this scene, I think. He did a terrific job as Khal Drogo all along, even though in the early episodes he has very little in the way of dialogue, and it's all physical acting. It's all his face and his eyes and his body movement. And the scene that you're about to see here is not one that I can claim credit for myself. I mean, I wrote this scene in the book up to about this point, but in the books, Mago, although he is unhappy about it, accepts the Khal's proclamation. I think it was actually Jason who came to David and Dan and said, you know, we hear a lot about how Khal Drogo is such a magnificent fighter, but we never see him fight. So let us see him fight. That wound, which of course will be very important, that he takes there in my original draft and in the books is given to him in the fight with the landmen, the Lazarine, and not in his fight with Magro. So there we have one of the more unforgettable, violent, and brutal moments in the show. And an action sequence that I think anybody who sees it will remember for a long, long time. You know, I've talked sometimes in interviews about what I call the butterfly effect, which name comes from that classic Ray Bradbury short story, The Sound of Thunder, where a man steps on a butterfly in the Jurassic and changes all of history that follows.
Thank you, Silver Lady.
Small changes may lead to larger changes going on. And that's always a challenge in an adaptation of a series of books as long as mine. In this case, we see a little example of the butterfly effect because Mago, who just died so memorably and excitingly, does not die in the books. And in fact, as I speak, the fifth book is about to come out, and Mago is still alive. Danny has promised him later in the first book that he will die screaming for the things he does later on, but he hasn't died screaming yet. So this is one thing where the television series and the books do diverge in the fate, the eventual fate of the character Mago. And now we're back at Winterfell with Robb Stark and Grey Wind, his direwolf, discussing his strategy with the Great John, played by Clive Mantle, the largest and fiercest and most belligerent of the bannermen of Winterfell, Great John Umber.
The bloody wall will melt before an Umber marches behind a Glover.
The Umbers are one of the more powerful of the bannermen of House Stark.
I will take my men and march them home.
Now, of course, in the books, where I have my cast of thousands, to do so, Lord Umber. There are considerably more people taking part in this argument.
I will march back north.
The Great John is saying why he should lead the vanguard, and other people are also arguing that they should lead the vanguard. Galbert Glover, his brother Robert Glover, Bruce Bolton is present, Mage Mormont, Rickard Karstark. All of these are characters, and they're implied here rather than seen. And some of them may come up in later seasons. But aside from being additional voices, they had no major part in this scene. So one of the realities of filming is you have to make decisions like that. Can't necessarily have 12 people gathered around a table with something to say.
Your meat! Is bloody tough.
The Great John, of course, is not actually pleased to have lost his fingers, but he's pleased to find that what he thought was a mere green boy has got some stones to him. Not to mention a big, large, mean direwolf.
What is it?
And Isaac Hempstead Wright is another of our child actors who's, I think, come through.
Where are you going?
Wonderfully for the show.
For father.
Of all the casting we had to do for Game of Thrones,
spies everywhere.
Finding the children was the hardest. And a lot of credit goes to our wonderful casting director, Nina Gold.
Can't I come with you? I can ride now. You've seen me riding. And I won't get in the way.
I mean, there are a lot of children in the world who would like to be in movies or television shows, but, you know, the sad truth is that most of them simply can't act, or at least they can't act yet. When you look at, as we did, hundreds of auditions for parts like Arya and Sansa and Bran, you find a lot of cute kids who are simply reciting the lines. And, you know, for an 8-year-old kid or a 9-year-old kid, 10-year-old kid, reciting the lines, that's a considerable achievement. I don't want to denigrate that by any means, but it's not acting. They're just a kid reciting lines. And then you get a minority who go to the other extreme. You know, they've been told that acting is emoting, so they over-emote. They chew the scenery, so to speak.
How long have you been hiding out there?
So we went through hundreds of actors until we found Isaac and Sophie and Arya. And once you find them, it's like finding a diamond in the rough.
Rob will free father.
It's just amazing. You just look at it and say, oh my God, yes, there's what we want. And this, of course, is the youngest Stark child, Rickon. Rickon is considerably older in the TV series than he is in the books. In the books, he's only a 3-year-old. And he's not a viewpoint character, simply because it was hard enough to write from a viewpoint of an 8-year-old. I couldn't imagine writing from a viewpoint of a 3-year-old. So we've aged him up. We've aged up all the characters a little, but I think it makes the largest difference with Rickon.
Your gods are answering you.
What are you doing here?
They're my gods, too. Beyond the wall, they're the only gods. Even slaves are allowed to pray.
You're not a slave. Well, your friend did put a knife to my throat.
Natalia Tena as Osha, the wildling who is captured by Robb Stark in the fight in the woods.
What do you mean about hearing the gods?
And brought back to serve as a captive and servant at Winterfell. Was perhaps the character that's the biggest change from the way I wrote her in the books.
It's only the wind.
Who do you think sends the wind, not the gods?
When I looked at the initial auditions for the part of Osha, you know, you see a still picture first when you go to these casting sites, and you click on it and the tape plays. And just looking at Natalia's picture, of course, I recognized her as Tonks from Harry Potter. And I said, no, she's all wrong for the part. She's much younger than Osha, she's written in the book. She's much more attractive the way Osha is written in the books. And then I clicked on her picture and she began to play her audition. And she was just wonderful. I couldn't take my eyes off her.
Are they really giants?
She was perhaps not the character as I had originally written, but in fact she was a much more interesting character than I had originally written, and one that I suddenly wanted to write about.
All these swords, they should be going north, boy.
People have asked me occasionally if the existence of the television show will impact the books. And for the most part, I think the answer is no. I'm going to write the books the way I've always intended to write the books. I have a pretty good idea of where I'm going, but there may be some influences in minor cases, and Osha is one of those cases. She's become such an interesting character in the TV show that when she reappears in the books, I'd really like to give her a more interesting role to play than I had perhaps originally had in mind.
Only fire will stop them. How do you know that? I read about it in a book, a very old book.
John Bradley West and Kit Harington as Sam and John. They have a marvelous dynamic going on there. I've asked sometimes if Sam was modeled after Sam from Lord of the Rings, and, you know, not directly, but there's maybe a bit of that.
What?
I hope the wall's high enough.
John Bradley West is another incredible actor that Nina Gold discovered for us. Straight out of drama school, no previous professional work. In fact, I understand that when he auditioned for the role of Sam, it was the first professional audition he'd ever done. And of course, he gets this role, which is a fairly plum role, so it's a little bit of a fairy tale for John, but he's doing a magnificent job, I think.
much knows, m'lady.
Robs brought the North with him.
The Riverlords are falling back, with Jaime Lannister at their heels. And Lord Tywin is bringing round a second Lannister army from the south. Our scouts confirm it's even larger than the Kingslayers.
One army or two? The kings in the north threw back hosts 10 times as large.
This scene is pretty much similar to the scene in the books, except for the setting. In the books, this meeting takes place at Mote Callon, which is a ruined castle surrounded by swamps. We've simplified it here.
I thought not to meet you here, milady.
I had not thought to be here. I would speak with my son alone. I know you will forgive me, my lords.
You were.
But although the setting has changed, the thrust of the scene is pretty much the same.
You too, Greyjoy. You're bloody deaf. Have no fear, my lady.
One of the things I was pleased with that we were able to do, which the scene reflects, is the idea of some strategy going on with this war. It's a pet peeve of mine as someone who's a fan of fantasy and historical fiction and these things also as they're seen in movies and television.
I remember the day
that in too many movies and television shows, when they're doing a war or a battle, all you see is two armies lined up on opposite sides of the field, and then they rush at each other and begin hacking and slashing.
Who were those men I saw here?
There's so seldom any sense of everything that goes into a campaign, the logistics of it, the difficulties of feeding the army, the question of high ground, of flanking the enemy, of surprising the enemy, all of the stuff that Sun Tzu wrote about in The Art of War, all of the things that actual generals and commanders have to do. I wanted to give some sense of it, both in the books and in the television show. So in this whole first campaign here, deception and geography are a huge part of what's going on. Where the river is, where the armies are, taking the enemy by surprise. And we're able to get a sense of that in this brief scene, and that pleased me greatly, pleased me no end.
If I go to King's Landing,
and this is a beautiful scene too, I think, between Rob and his mother.
Our best hope, our only hope.
The dynamic when they first meet, where clearly they want to embrace each other, but
do you know what happened to the Targaryen children?
Rob has to be very careful of how he's perceived by his men. He can't look like a mommy's boy. He's their leader, he's their lord, so long as Ned remains a captive. He's leading them to war, and in this very sexist and masculinist society, he's got to come across as macho, so they wait until the lords have left before they actually embrace, which was perfect, beautiful staging. This is a scene which I think works well, but it's one of those impacted by the budget.
From here, it might be best.
Of course, in my first draft of the script and in the books, everybody here is on a horse. They're not actually walking out of the mountains. There's a large force of people who are riding out of the mountains.
And feed it to the goats, yes.
But I guess we exhausted our horse budget, so
all right, then.
The characters are on foot instead.
I'm to meet my father.
And I love the Lannister camp with the red tents. Beautifully imagined, sells, you know, which army this is instantly, without having to have a voiceover or a label on the screen. You see the banners, and you see the color of the tents, and you know who you are.
Tyrion.
Uncle?
Here's Lord Tywin himself. Charles Dance.
The rumors of your
another actor who we really wanted. Our leading choice for this role. Very pleased to have gotten him.
And who are these companions of yours?
This is Shaga, son of Dolph.
chieftain of the Stone Crows. Timit, son of Timit, ruler of the Burned Men. This fair maid is Chella, daughter of Chek, leader of the Black Ears. And here we have Bronn, son of...
You wouldn't know him.
May I present my lord...
That's a wonderful line. It's not one I can actually take credit for.
Lord of Casterly Rock.
I believe in the books, Tyrion says, this is Bronn, son of no one in particular. And that was the line as I wrote it in my first draft. It got changed along the way. I don't know if that was actually an ad-lib by Jeremy Flynn or whether David and Dan changed that line in rewrites, but it's one of the cases where I think they improve things. I wish I had thought of that line. That was very funny.
And now lay siege to Riverrun, Catelyn Stark's homeland.
And Stark's, Lord Eddard?
Is our hostage. He will lead no armies from his dungeon cell.
How did my sweet sister persuade the king to imprison his dear friend Ned?
Robert Baratheon is dead. Joffrey rules in King's Landing.
Tyrion, of course, has been walking through the mountains, so he doesn't know any of this stuff. Rules, you mean?
Stark's son has called his banners. He moves south with a strong host.
Green boy. One taste of battle and he'll run back to Winterfell with his tail between his legs.
Maybe. Though the boy does have a certain belligerence, you'd like him. While we're on the subject of war, I made promises to my friends.
The staging of the scene, I think, is terrific. The way Tyrion keeps reaching for the wine, and his father, of course, who disapproves of his drinking and his whoring, keeps denying him the wine without a word being said about it. It's just physical action. And now, I don't know if the director, Dan Minahan, added that when he blocked the scene, whether it's something the actors contributed himself, whether David and Dan put in some stage directions in a later draft of the script. But whoever added it, it's a beautiful riff, and it's great to have it in there, just a little character moment between two men without a word being spoken. And Tyrion gets to wine at last.
The men of the Mountain Clans are great warriors. Ride with me against my enemies, and you shall have all my son promised you and more.
A little strange here that Shaga seems smaller than Lord Tywin. Because Shaga is very large. But here he's got Tibbet standing next to him. He's even larger.
The scouts report Lord Tywin moves north. We need to get him on.
And once again, we're getting a sense of strategy and... We need to get around the problems of Jaime Lannister's siege of Riverrun. Warfare, strategy, tactics, maneuvering the armies, dealing with where the enemy is and trying to take him by surprise.
The only crossing is at the Twins.
Lord Frey controls that bridge. Your father's bannerman.
The late Lord Frey, my father calls him. At the Trident, he didn't appear until the battle was done. Some men take their oaths more seriously than others.
The introduction of the Freys, a little backstory. There's a lot of backstory in my books.
Rob's right.
The story picks up, but it's not necessarily at the beginning. The things that happened 15 years ago, the things that happened 300 years ago, the things that happened thousands of years ago still have bearing on what's happening in the present, which is a real challenge for the screenwriters to get in all of this backstory.
Where did you find him?
As a novelist, I have advantages that a screenwriter doesn't have. I have tools like internal monologue, unreliable narrator. I have the whole point of view technique. But the screenwriter has different tools at his disposal. And you have to make adjustments to use the weapons that you're given.
You don't have to do this yourself. Your father would understand if
I... My father understands mercy when there is room for it. And he understands honor.
Now, Rob, of course, is being very clever here.
Let him go.
Rob.
He's letting the scout go. But the scout has an inflated idea of the size of Rob's army. And Rob is now about to give him the wrong impression about what he's going to do with that army.
Tell Lord Tywin, winter is coming for him. 20,000 northerners marching south to find out if he really does shit gold.
So he's going to return to...
Yes, my lord.
...the Lannisters.
Thank you, my lord.
...with bad information, which is exactly what Rob wants. So this is what I'm trying to get into. This whole sense of a chess game going on, a chess game played with armies and with human pieces.
Boy again.
Go on.
The Great John is loyal, but not as quick as he might be. He doesn't understand what Rob's done here.
It is also the wish of his grace that his loyal servant, Janos Slint, commander of the city watch, be at once raised to the rank of lord and granted the ancient seat of Harrenhal, and that his sons and grandsons shall hold this honor after him until the end of time.
So, Janos Slint, commander of the City Watch, who was instrumental in Ned's fall, is being rewarded for his treachery from the Stark viewpoint, loyalty from the Lannister viewpoint.
Warden of the West, be appointed Hand of the King. Lastly, in these times of treason and turmoil, it is the view of Council that the life and safety of King Joffrey be of paramount importance.
Sir Barristan Selmy.
Sir Barristan Selmy, played by Ian McElhinney. Sir Barristan, the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, most honorable knight in the kingdom, but one who formerly served House Targaryen before Robert's Rebellion, and who was a reluctant participant in what just happened to the Starks. So the Lannisters are moving him aside here.
Every man and woman in the Seven Kingdoms owes you thanks. But it is time to put aside your armor and your sword. It is time to rest and look back with pride on your many years of service.
Your Grace, the King's Guard is a sworn brotherhood. Our vows are taken for life, only death.
Part of the reason that Sir Barristan is being moved out is because the Kingsguard, the order of sworn brothers who protect the king, is traditionally made up of only 7 men. And Joffrey wishes to reward the Hound, Sandor Clegane, by making him one of the Kingsguard. But before he can do that, he has to make a vacancy, lose one of the current 7, and especially the Lord Commander. So this allows them to make Jaime Lannister Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, and to make Sandor Clegane a Knight of the Kingsguard.
And men to bury me. I am a knight. I shall die a knight.
A naked knight, apparently.
Even now, I could cut through the 5 of you like carving a cake. Here, boy. Melt it down and add it to the others.
Now, of course, there are many more than 5 men in the scene, but the 5 he's referring to there is the 5 other members of the Kingsguard. He is the 6th, and Jaime, who is off, is the 7th.
If any man in this hall has other matters to set before his grace, let him speak now, or go forth and hold his silence.
Your grace.
Come forward, my lady.
Sansa's big moment, a scene that takes considerable courage from her, and I think beautifully acted by Sophie here.
King and the council, Sansa. I do. As it please your grace, I ask mercy for my father. Lord Eddard Stark, who is Hand of the King.
Treason is a noxious weed. It should be torn out.
Roots. Let her speak. I want to hear what she says.
Pycelle is still stuck in his bad cop role.
Do you deny your father's crime?
He's trying to ingratiate himself. Pycelle sort of
he must be punished.
Lick spittle.
All I ask is mercy. I know my lord father must regret what he did. He was King Robert's friend and he loved him. You all know he loved him. He never wanted to be hanged until the king asked him. They must have lied to him, Lord Renly or Lord Stannis or somebody. They must have lied.
He said I wasn't the king.
Jack Gleeson, again, is another marvelous discovery for us.
He was badly hurt. Maester Pycelle was giving him milk of the poppy.
He's really a very nice young man. I met him when the first time I visited the set, and he was charming and friendly, and I wrote him after the first few episodes here and said, congratulations, Jack, on your marvelous performance. Everyone hates you now. And I think it's true. Joffrey is universally loathed, and that's a testament to Jack's acting abilities.
If you still have any affection in your heart for me, please do me this kindness, Your Grace.
Your sweet words have moved me. But your father has to confess. He has to confess and say that I'm the king. Or there'll be no mercy for him.
And there's the rub, of course.
He will.
Beautiful final shot, I thought. With the prongs of the throne coming up to obscure Sansa. The sharp prongs of the throne made of swords of fallen enemies. Weapons of death and destruction, with all the symbolism that that carries with it. So there we go, the pointy end. Thanks for listening, folks.